You good? The injured recon marine looked over from his seat. Yeah, he replied, giving a nod that rustled his suit. Parnell had insisted on joining them, but the marine was loopy from the meds. Even if Beckham trusted the guy to shoot straight on those painkillers, the injured marine would slow them down more than Beckham with his peg leg. He had finally convinced Parnell to stay and guard the chopper with Liam. The bird lowered over the destroyed city streets, flying over mounds of collapsed buildings and a disintegrated highway overpass where chunks of concrete had smashed a convoy of vehicles.
Oh my God, Rico said.
What? Beckham asked.
That's the former outpost, she said.
Beckham didn't see what had caught her attention. The city looked the same here as it did everywhere. How do you know? He asked.
See all those cars and trucks around the interstate? She asked. Looks like a convoy, either trying to escape or looking for shelter.
In the pale moonlight, Beckham surveyed the remains of the caravan. Every car represented a family or group of neighbors who had been fleeing when the nuke had landed. These refugees had died partly because of him, because he had agreed with the order to drop the bombs and fire the missiles that had destroyed so much of their own country. An overwhelming sense of regret washed through him. Lord have mercy on us, Beckham whispered. Parnell made the sign of the cross with his good hand. Another few minutes passed by in silence, everyone in the troop hold shocked by the destruction.
Here we go, Liam said.
He prepared their final approach on the outskirts of the city. Beckham looked for their target, Golden, Colorado. The facility that had once developed medical therapeutics from donated human tissues. Now Beckham feared it was being used to make monsters from those tissues instead.
Looks clear, Liam said.
He circled on the first pass.
I don't see any hostiles.
Dig us down, Beckham ordered.
Copy. Everyone hold on to something.
Beckham grabbed a handhold as the chopper descended. They landed hard, slamming the wheels on the pavement, and Parnell whimpered in pain from the restraints pressing on his wound. Rico and Horn hopped out to secure the area. Beckham stood next to Parnell. Snow fell around them, mixing with the carpet of ash on the ground.
You sure you'll be okay? Beckham asked the Marine.
I'm good.
Parnell grabbed an MP5 submachine with his good hand. Long as I can reload. Beckham held up his prosthetic hand.
Take good care of Liam and the chopper.
You got it, Captain.
Parnell stood and stepped outside. He wobbled slightly until he leaned against the hull of the bird. Beckham hobbled over to the cockpit.
This could take a while. If we're not back in a few hours...
I'll wait as long as it takes. I don't have to be anywhere else.
Thanks, Liam. You're a good man.
Beckham lowered himself carefully out of the chopper and joined Rico and Horn. The town of Golden had been far enough from the nuclear blast it had mostly survived. By the looks of it, their target, Humosource, had too. But the entire place looked like a ghost town. The team advanced through the darkness, flakes of snow falling lifelessly from the sky. It was like entering a post-apocalyptic wintry wasteland. Filthy snow covered the streets and rooftops. The rectangular Humosource building wasn't far, and Beckham saw it a moment later. He had expected it to be covered in red webbing, but it too was painted in the dirty snow.
Rico, take point, Beckham said.
She took lead, her suit crinkling as she cleared the sidewalk in front of the building. Snow and ash fell around her, filling her footsteps nearly as soon as she left them. The doors to the lobby were open. She peered inside using the light mounted on her rifle, then gestured it was clear. They advanced inside. Shadows smothered the interior. Beckham and Horn flicked on their tactical lights. Their beams revealed a lobby furnished with tables and chairs covered in dust. It appeared this place hadn't changed since before the Great War, and Beckham had a hard time believing the intel Kate and Sammy had provided. The only evidence of life here were boot prints in the dirt covering the floor. Those could have been from bandits or civilians. He saw nothing that led him to believe there was a mastermind or even variants around. Beckham gave Rico an advance signal. Despite his reservations, they had to make a comprehensive sweep to ensure they didn't miss anything. Rico led them down a corridor framed with large glass windows that revealed vast clean rooms. Large stainless steel tables were lined up in rows, and industrial refrigerators and cabinets full of glassware were pressed against the walls. They passed a door that led to an anteroom into the clean room. Pegs on the wall inside held ragged-looking overall suits, and boxes of rotting latex gloves lay on a table beside them, along with stacks of clean room booties to cover shoes. The layers of dust were thick here, too. Rico took them past another set of glass doorways, each leading to a room filled with cubicles. Beckham limped up to one of the glass doors and shone his light through. It fell on desks filled with old computers and telephones, boxes of papers stacked next to them. The thought that this was another dead end was hard to swallow, especially with the sacrifices of the Marines who hadn't even made it here. Rico took another corner, locating something Beckham hadn't expected. A blast door to an underground shelter. The wall that had blocked off the door was broken open, drywall and boards ripped apart. Even more surprising, the blast door was open. More footprints tracked through the dust. These went both in and out of the door. Rico looked back for orders. Beckham paused, then gave her the nod to continue. She went through the shelter door using the tack light to illuminate a pair of massive elevator doors with a mirror-like finish. Two buttons next to them operated it, but the power was out. Beckham found the entrance to a stairwell. Horn went first with his saw shouldered. Rico followed and Beckham went last. He took each step carefully, his damaged prosthetic ringing on each step, making his descent difficult. By the time they hit the bottom of the five flights, he was sweating inside his CBRN suit, and pain throbbed up what remained of his leg. Horn stopped at another steel door, and Rico joined him. It was slightly ajar, and Horn used his body to press it open, the sound echoing in a cavernous space. The trio slipped inside, their flashlights piercing the overwhelming black. An incessant buzz filled the long room, almost like they had entered a beehive. Beckham nearly took a step backward when his light hit a swarm of flies. He kept walking, ignoring the insects that could only mean something dead was down here. In the middle of the room were examination tables and rolling carts full of bone saws, dissection tools, and more. Against one wall were rows and rows of smaller doors that appeared to be part of a massive morgue cabinet. Horn went to one and slid it open. Then he stepped away to flash his light over the remains of a corpse. There were so many squirming maggots inside that the rotting flesh looked like it was moving. Beckham pulled open another to find the same morbid sight. Each mortuary drawer was stuffed with decayed bodies. The nuclear attack had cut the power. Without electricity, the morgue cabinet had stopped working, letting the corpses rot away. Judging by the maggots chewing through their flesh, the corpses hadn't been left alone all that long ago. That meant someone had been storing these bodies. But the question was why? The images of all those horrifically decayed people lingered on Beckham's mind as they entered another chamber in this subterranean hellhole. This was worse than the first. There were six surgical tables, each topped with a bloated corpse. Behind the tables were lab benches covered in microscopes and other equipment. Freezers and refrigerators stood next to them. Beckham walked in slowly, stomach churning, as his light fell on the decomposing cadavers. They were all in various stages of dissection. Cut open chests and stomachs revealed leathery organs twisted in rot. But these bodies weren't like the ones in the morgue cabinets. Even with their putrefied flesh, Beckham noticed the claws at the end of their fingers. Their lips had dried out, peeling back to reveal pointed teeth. Horn and Rico spread out to sweep the rest of this macabre lab.
"What is this place?"
Horn asked.
"The morgue from hell," Rico said.
"Gather any intel you can find," Beckham instructed. They scrounged through the plastic vials they found in the thawing freezers and the refrigerators. A pair of computers lay in another corner. These weren't covered in dust like the ones they'd seen upstairs. Beckham pried out the hard drives from each.
Got everything? Beckham asked.
Rico nodded.
Let's go then.
Good,
Horn said.
I can't wait to get the fuck out of here.
The team made their way topside. Beckham hobbled out of the open lobby doors with his rifle shouldered, scanning for targets. The chopper was still there, and two figures were standing in CBRN suits in front of it. Parnell must have finally convinced Liam to don a CBRN suit. Beckham was glad to see it.
You changed your mind?
He asked, lowering his rifle as they approached. Liam raised a pistol and pointed it at Beckham. Parnell raised his MP5. Beckham froze.
What are you doing?
He stammered. Liam walked forward with the gun trained on Beckham. Three more figures in CBRN suits suddenly came from around the chopper. Two had hostages, Parnell and Liam, still not wearing a suit. Realization set in. These people must have ambushed the pilot and Marine, then stolen those suits and weapons.
Take it easy, Beckham said,
his mind racing, trying to figure out if these were collaborators or someone else.
Give me the word, boss, and I'll light these fucks up,
Horn said. Rico roved her gun from target to target. I got a full magazine with hollow points for you assholes. Just try me.
No,
Beckham said, holding up his prosthetic. Even if they took out a couple, these people would take out at least one of his team members. That was a risk he was unwilling to take.
Everyone put down your weapons, Beckham said. Let's figure this out and talk. No one needs to die.
We just want to ride out of here,
said the person with the pistol pointed at Beckham. The voice was female, and she sounded sick, her voice crackling. If these people had just put on the suits, they were probably already suffering the first symptoms of radiation poisoning.
We can help you, Beckham said. Just put your guns down.
Take us somewhere safe, said the woman. Promise us that, and we'll put down our weapons. I swear that's all we want.
Rico let out a huff and lowered her rifle slightly. Ain't no place safe anymore, lady, she said. Kate surveyed the networking station in the tunnels beneath Lower Manhattan. The temperature was high as usual, and sweat trickled down her neck under her splash suit. It was almost as bad as the stale, filtered air in her mask. Besides a few piles of loose rock and dirt and the ankle-deep water, nothing in the tunnel looked amiss. The equipment was still here, and aside from a knocked-over floodlight, it was all unharmed. The generator had still been running when they had returned, casting the space in a blinding yellow glow. Wynn and his three soldiers had taken their sentry positions. Ron and Leslie checked over the network cables connected with the webbing, monitoring the physical connections with the red growths covering the walls. How's everything look? Kate asked. Sammy sat in a chair behind a computer station and checked the monitor.
We're in better shape than I thought we would be.
Good. Go ahead and open the signaling gates, Kate instructed. Sammy's fingers worked across the keyboard. Then she sat back as her programs loaded.
You okay?
Kate asked, noticing Sammy clutching her side again.
Yeah. I don't think we'll have any major problems decoding the variant signals now. It won't be long before we know enough to send signals of our own. I'm not talking about the software, I'm talking about you.
Sammy paused.
I'm hurting, but I won't let that stop me.
Kate placed a hand on her shoulder.
That's admirable, but don't push yourself too hard. Ron and Leslie have been keeping pace with our technical work. They can step in if you need a break.
Sammy's programs reported the computer had a complete connection with the variant network.
You want me to search for keywords again?
Sammy asked. Kate nodded.
See if there are any other attacks planned for our location.
They searched through the cascade of signals pulsing through the webbing into Sammy's computer. It took a few minutes for her natural language processing algorithms to decode the message and provide them a report.
That's strange, Sammy said.
What?
Kate asked.
Sergeant Wynn walked over, cradling his rifle.
Something wrong?
No, it's working, Sammy said. We got hits for keywords like attack and New York. None of them mention another attack tonight in this vicinity, though. Well, that's good, right? Leslie asked. Wynn adjusted the strap on his rifle, stepping closer.
Yeah, why do you think it's strange?
Because the monsters haven't given us a break since they started this war, Sammy said. It's odd that they would send those bats and nothing else.
Kate worried they were missing something, a piece of the puzzle that wasn't obvious.
We're only looking at real-time messages, right?
Sammy nodded.
That's correct. Everything we see is being intercepted right now. If the variants already sent the orders to attack the base, then we may have already missed it, Kate said. We need to monitor this station 24/7. We might have missed vital information since the last attack.
Shit, Sammy said.
So there might be another attack after all? Ron asked nervously.
I don't know, but I want to download all incoming signals from here on out, Kate said. We can't afford to miss a single second of variant messages. That means we'll send a remote server and extra drives. The hard drives on these computers can't store everything.
Kate turned to Ron. I need your help to set that up, okay?
Ron nodded.
I'm sure we can help find that for you in the CIC, Wynn said. I'll send one of my men back with Ron. Is there anything else you need?
Not yet, but give us a second, Kate said. Maybe we can send some useful intel back to the CIC with them. Sammy, see if there are reports on any attacks planned for other outposts.
Moments later, Sammy had a list of outposts that had come up in her queries. Kate thought of all the men, women, and children at those outposts. They had to warn them.
Sammy, make sure this list of outposts is comprehensive, she said. Sergeant Wynn, Ron, and your man can give President Ringgold this list when they go back to the CIC.
Wynn sent Ron and a soldier off to the CIC. At least now the people in those outposts would have a fighting chance at escaping, even though she wasn't sure if there was anywhere to escape to. But Kate was no longer content with learning how to listen to the variant communications. They had designed this software for another purpose, and now that Sammy had cracked the code on all the monster signals, they would put it to the real test.
You designed this software for communicating with the masterminds too, Kate said. I don't want to just be passive observers. I want to be proactive. We need to disrupt their communications. It's time to send some signals of our own.
Sammy took a deep breath and nodded. Her fingers danced across the keyboard as she prepared to send out the signals.
I've already identified the source nodes for the masterminds where most of these signals originated from. We now have a complete range of signals we can deliver thanks to our work in the bunker, Sammy said. If we try to spoof them, we should be able to route a message through the masterminds that can be disseminated to the other nodes and the end-user variants and collaborators.
English? Wynn asked.
We can tell the variants what to do, Kate said. That means, if it works, we can call off the attack, Leslie said.
Maybe, Kate replied.
Okay, Sammy, where do we begin? We have comprehensive examples of the language the monsters use to give each other commands now. All I have to do is model our signal off that, Sammy said. And when you're ready, I'll send it.
Kate read over the command. It mirrored the cadence and manner of text-based messages they'd seen the masterminds send to each other. Delay attack on Danbury until tomorrow night. This is what they had been working for. Kate had hoped they would be able to test this in a laboratory setting, but as they had learned when they first tried observing the variant signals out here, a laboratory setting just wasn't good enough. She tried to take solace in the fact that they now had a full library of signals from variants and sources of all sorts. Hopefully this time they would do better than when their failed experiments resulted in her husband and the other soldiers getting attacked by the Red Vines. If this succeeded, they could change the face of this war. They could interfere with the commands between variants, and even if they couldn't get the masterminds to do exactly what they wanted, they could sow confusion in their ranks. But it could also backfire spectacularly, Kate realized. She thought they had all the data they needed this time to make it work. With no other choice, Kate gave the order.
Send the message, she said.
Sammy pressed a single button that could change everything. The rest of the team gathered around, all of them no doubt feeling their kicking hearts as they waited to see if the variants would acquiesce. A computerized reply from a mastermind appeared on their screen a moment later. Kate clenched her hands together and bent down to read it. Message unclear. Biological signature indeterminate. Suspected error.
What does that mean?
Leslie asked.
I'm not sure,
Sammy said. She sent a few more inquiries, and the responses all came back the same.
It's not working.
Sammy leaned away from the computer.
Why isn't it working?
She sounded desperate.
This biological signature thing doesn't make sense, Kate said. What's it asking for?
Sammy read the text again.
I think I know what's going on. We're sending messages through a computer. Everything we're reading is actually coming from masterminds, though, not computers. I thought the software was ready, Leslie said. Did we do something wrong? The truth is, my algorithms do a good job translating the signals into a language we can understand. Think of it like a computer dictation program. For instance, when you dictate something, your computer transcribes the words you say into text on your screen.
Wynn sighed.
So, what's the problem with that?
When the computer transcribes all that, you lose things like tone and volume. All those subtle clues that tell you whether a person is sarcastic or angry or serious, for instance. Well, how do we do that? Leslie asked.
Kate had kept quiet to consider the implications of what Sammy had said. She didn't like what she was about to say, but there was only one way Kate could think of to interject the biological signature their messages were missing.
We need to connect with the webbing, Kate said. I thought we already were, Leslie said.
No, Kate said. She put a hand over her chest. She recalled the story she heard of Dohai being captured, how the webbing had subverted his consciousness, and how the webbing had captured Beckham and those outpost soldiers elsewhere in this tunnel. The webbing wasn't just capable of connecting to the network. It was designed to integrate with human and variant bodies.
We need a biological connection, Kate said. Jesus, are you saying what I think you're saying? Leslie asked. She's right. We need a person instead of just a computer to connect to the network, Sammy said.
That's insane, Wynn said.
Once again, Kate imagined the families like hers that were out there frightened in the face of unimaginable horrors.
I'll do it, Kate said.
Sammy hesitated.
Are you sure? There's no other way.
Wynn looked between Kate and Sammy.
Use me. You're too important, Dr. Lovato.
Which is why I need to do it, Kate replied. I have the most experience interacting with the masterminds. Throwing you in there would be like dropping someone who can't speak Spanish into Mexico City and telling them to blend in. It simply wouldn't work.
Wynn didn't argue with that logic.
Leslie, cut off a piece of the webbing and bring me one of the microarrays, Kate said.
Using a knife, Leslie cut off a foot-long length of red webbing from the wall. It pulsed in her hand like a worm as she brought it back to Sammy with the microarray. The computer engineer clipped the microarray to the webbing and attached the microarray to her laptop.
You're just going to use this to plug into the webbing? Leslie asked.
Yeah, basically, Sammy said.
We learned from the webbing when it attacked our people and from the mastermind when we had it in our custody back in Manchester that these red vines can pierce a person or variant skin. It can connect directly to their nervous system. My husband saw the head of a variant in the tunnel when he was captured, Kate said. It was still alive, even without a body.
Because of the webbing?
Wynn asked.
I believe so. We accidentally activated the webbing before, and because of our mistakes, it tried to integrate him and a few other soldiers into the network.
Shit. So you're going to try to do that again?
Wynn said.
You're not going to test this out on mice or something first?
Kate shook her head.
There's no animal model for this, and it's too late. We simply don't have the time. Leslie, hold the webbing at the base of Kate's neck, Sammy said. We haven't run into any contaminants yet, but I want to minimize the amount of Kate's skin exposed to the air just in case.
Understood, Leslie said. Kate sat down on a chair and felt the wet warmth of the webbing against the base of her neck.
I'm going to try the commands that triggered the webbing when it attacked your husband, Sammy said. If it works, you'll be connected straight to the computer and the network almost immediately. The computer should still be able to translate the signal's words so you can understand them. But now we'll also have your additional tonal and contextual input.
Kate mentally steeled herself. She wasn't sure she ever could prepare for something like this, but she did her best to manage her breathing and heart rate.
Do it, she said.
A click on the keyboard was the last thing Kate heard. Electricity jolted through her nerves, and her vision darkened. Pain swam through her body, filling her vessels with fire. She vaguely recalled Beckham saying he had experienced a similar sensation. Suddenly, she reached a strange clarity. The pain dissolved, and she heard voices in her mind. She was connected. Kate focused on the words they'd sent before. Delay attack on Danbury until tomorrow night. Over and over, she repeated those words in a commanding tone as the darkness in her vision filled with wild sparks. Countless voices chattered in her conscious, some angry, some in pain, others in shock. Suddenly, another voice boomed past them. Confirm attack delay on Danbury. It was directed at her. Yes, confirm, she thought. The pain started to overwhelm her again, distracting her. The fire in her veins was too much, and she let out a scream. Her vision suddenly returned, and she opened her eyes to the web-covered tunnel. A masked face hovered in front of hers. It was Sergeant Wynn.
Are you okay? He asked.
Kate's head throbbed, but she nodded.
I think so. I heard the voices. Thousands of them. Like a hive of trapped minds. You sounded like you were being tortured, Sammy said quietly.
Kate sat straighter. She had never felt so exhausted.
Did it work?
Sammy turned to her computer to read the messages flickering over the screen. Leslie and Wynn helped Kate to stand. She leaned down to read the text. Squinting, Kate read the last words that Sammy had intercepted from a mastermind. Attack on Danbury canceled. It had worked. 21. Nick followed Pete under a canopy of pine trees outside the mountain base to greet the general of the new guards. Now that it was dark, they expected the convoy to arrive soon, but they hadn't heard anything from their contacts on precisely when they would arrive. Using his flashlight, Nick carefully made his way down the steep trail. As much as he wanted to meet one of the leaders responsible for planning this war over the last 8 years, he had been distracted by thoughts of Ray and his wife. While his mind had drowned in those thoughts, Pete had hardly spoken about what happened in the stairwell. That changed now that they were alone outside.
Ray didn't just trip down those stairs, did he? Pete said.
He brushed his dreadlocks over his shoulder and turned slightly for an answer. Nick opened his mouth to speak, but Pete held up a hand.
Don't lie to me, Nick, Pete said. You know I hate liars.
Nick had seen Pete kill for less.
Ray said he fucked Diana, Nick said. I kicked his ass where he belonged, into a puddle of his own blood.
Pete reared back slightly.
Well, did he?
Nick swallowed hard.
I don't know. If he did, what you'll do is focus on our mission with the new guards, Pete said. That's an order.
I know. I'm focused more than ever before.
I told you I hate liars.
Pete stared at him.
You don't seem focused. Ray didn't exactly die on the stairs. He's haunting your thoughts.
Nick held Pete's gaze.
Fuck Ray, Pete finally said. We won't need him for what's next. Especially if I'm right about the last part of this war.
He patted Nick on the back. But that didn't help him feel any better. He couldn't fathom Diana betraying him with Ray, of all people. What could possibly be the reason?
Focus, Nick. Focus.
He pulled his coat hood up over his cap. As the minutes ticked by, the temperature continued to drop. Pete led them between the dense trees over a hidden trail until they reached an overlook. There was a sniper there in a ghillie suit. The sniper looked away from his scope, but remained in position.
You see anything yet? Pete asked.
Nothing on the road, sir.
Nick stepped up to the edge of the rocky outcrop. A dirt road snaked through the valley below. That was where the general's convoy would be coming from. They endured the cold in silence, waiting. Nick wiggled his toes and curled his fingers repeatedly to keep the blood flowing. A light drizzle made it worse. The cold rain stung his bearded face. The more time that passed, the more his mind drifted back to his wife and Ray. Had she really touched that filthy piece of shit? The thought broke his heart. Everything he had done was for her and their girls. Everything. He had risked so much to give them a life better than wasting away in that cabin, fighting to build a life for them here. A distant hum snapped him from his anger. Pete heard it too. He shouldered his rifle and looked to the sky. Had the military found them? They had been close before, bombing the exterior of the mountain where they kept some of their prisoners.
Get down, Pete ordered.
Nick scanned the clouds for an incoming drone, but spotted a small black helicopter. He recognized it as it grew closer. It was a little bird that special operators had once used. Figures rode on the platforms.
Oh, fuck, Nick said.
He aimed his rifle, his heart pounding. If the military had brought one chopper, there would be more. While their small army here was well armed, a Delta Force or Navy SEAL strike team landing in full force could be devastating. Pete's radio buzzed.
We just received a message that the general is landing, a voice said.
The report sent a wave of relief through Nick. He lowered his rifle and exhaled.
Shit, let's go, Pete said. We can't be late.
Watch the road, Nick said to the sniper. Make sure no one followed them. The man nodded. Pete started back over the path, running fast. Nick followed, his flashlight bobbing. They took another rocky trail that was guarded by two sentries who saluted when they passed. Pete ignored them and continued until they came to a clearing. Lungs burning from the cold, Nick tried to catch his breath at the edge of the forest. The chopper had already landed, its rotors idle. A group of people entered another hidden opening into the mountains, this one meant for vehicles. Pete and Nick ran to catch up before the blast doors closed. Sporadic banks of overhead lights cast the corridor in a dim glow. Guards posted along the sides of the blast doors were on their knees, head bowed at the envoy of five men dressed in black fatigues. It didn't take long for Nick to spot the leader. The general was nearly a foot taller than his men, and much wider.
Welcome to Mount Karadin, Pete said. I'm Commander Pete.
The general turned, his face no longer concealed by the shadows. Nick risked a glance, expecting the man to be part variant. But this creature was all monster. A black robe covered the beastly frame of an alpha variant that looked as if he had survived from the first war. Nick hadn't seen one for years. Before he could get a good look, Nick went down on a knee next to Pete, both bowing.
Show me,
said the general in a deep, crackly voice. It cleared its voice before continuing.
Show me the weapon.
Yes, General, Pete said.
Now,
the general boomed. Pete and Nick stood and hurried around the Alpha variant and its entourage. The escorts walked like humans, but behind their masks, Nick saw the golden eyes of the Scions. He had only seen a few of the biologically engineered super soldiers the new gods had created, and being in their presence now was thrilling. The beasts cradled automatic rifles and had saw-toothed cutlasses strapped over their backs. These biologically engineered Scions were the apostles of the new gods and the secret weapon that was winning the war. And the Allied states hadn't even seen their full potential yet. VX-99 had indeed created the super soldiers it was designed to, and Nick was in their presence. He couldn't help but feel some pride. After all, it was partly thanks to his research that they had found a way to use VX-99 on other creatures, like bats and dogs. But he couldn't take credit for these men. That was done out west. Pete took them into the silo, passing down the corridors until they got to a blast door. He used a keycard to open it and then stepped onto a platform.
"This is it," he said.
Nick followed him over the metal catwalk, keeping his gaze down. The general stepped onto the platform. His armored reptilian feet and claws clicked on the metal. Pete turned on the lights, and Nick got his first good look at the creature examining the missile. Standing 7 feet tall, with shoulders as wide as two men, the size alone impressed him. But it was the horrific face that made this alpha a truly remarkable beast. His crocodile-like jaw cracked open as he breathed through long, slitted nostrils and exhaled through thin, sucker lips. Sunken eyes flitted up and down at the missile. The general whirled toward Nick and Pete, robe whipping behind him as he strode over. Nick lowered his eyes as it scrutinized him and Pete. Hot breath washed over them as the creature exhaled.
"Look at me,"
it hissed in a scratchy voice. Nick stared at the slotted yellow eyes that seemed to stare into his heart. Like all of the alphas, this one could hardly speak without its voice crackling.
"Our enemies are infiltrating the network," the general said. "We must find out where they are doing this."
It took a moment for Nick to grasp those implications. How in the hell had their enemies gotten into the network? Pete nodded.
"Yes, General. I'll radio my team right away."
He pulled out his radio, but the creature gestured to the nuclear missile.
"Prepare the weapon," he said. "We must proceed with the last stages of our plan. The infiltration of these heretics won't matter then."
Pete bowed. "It will be my honor, General." The creature snorted at Nick.
"You take me to feed."
Pete exchanged a glance with Nick.
"Take them to the prisoners," Pete said. "I'll prepare the missile."
"Right away," Nick said. "Follow me." He led them through the tunnels and toward the entrance to the chambers where they had fed their thrall armies in the past. When Nick stepped into the first chamber, he recalled Timothy, the young man they had brought here. New fresh meat was pinned on the walls, strung up by the few remaining thrall variants roaming the foothills. "There," Nick said. He pointed to three humans, their heads drooped, sleeping or unconscious. The general ducked into the chamber, but his men stayed back, holding guard. Nick felt the icy stab of fear as the Alpha descended toward the three prisoners. He wasn't sure why, but being so close to such a remarkable monster was both terrifying and humbling. One of the prisoners, a female with long hair, slick with blood, looked up and moaned. Her eyes cracked open in the moonlight. The Alpha ripped her neck with a slash of his claws before she could scream. Blood sloshed out onto the ground. It leaned down to feed, opening its long reptilian jaw. The lips bloomed open like flower petals, extending over her face and clamping down. The beast slurped and sucked off the flesh for a few long moments. When it was done, it pulled away, leaving glistening bone and muscle. A long tongue whipped out of the sucker lips to lick the blood off its face. Most people would have turned away in horror, but not Nick. He watched the beast that would help lead them to victory with a grim satisfaction. A voice pierced Fitz's mind from a pool of blackness. It sounded like it was calling to end the attacks on all the outposts.
Was that Kate? He wondered dreamily.
It couldn't be Kate. Even in his dream state, he knew that wasn't possible. An agonized scream snapped him awake. His eyelids flipped open, but the world around him was a crimson blur. A sickening odor of rotting fruit and putrid meat filled his raw nostrils. He reached instinctively for his rifle, but his hands were stuck. Memories crashed down around him like an avalanche. He recalled the chimeras swarming him and Ace. He remembered their hunger-filled eyes. He had expected claws and teeth to sink into his flesh but the monsters had taken him and Ace prisoner. The last thing he recalled was a chimera slamming the butt of a rifle into his forehead in some sort of lab. Now questions broke through the haze of pain. Where was he? What were they going to do to him? And where was Ace? He tried to twist his head to get a better look at his surroundings, but something tugged against it. His legs and arms, too, were completely secured. He bent his head forward just enough to see he was cocooned in crimson webbing. That same webbing had punctured his fingers, squirming just beneath his skin. The more he blinked, the clearer his vision became, until he could see a wide room the size of a basketball court with a ceiling nearly 20 feet high. Thick red webbing, throbbing and writhing, covered every surface, including him and other prisoners. The scene reminded him of the cathedral in New Orleans and the theater in Minneapolis where they'd encountered the masterminds. But there didn't seem to be a mastermind here, just tables filled with laboratory equipment and a row of 3 huge silver cylinders. Fitz vaguely recalled Kate calling these machines bioreactors. He struggled to get free, but the webbing tightened with each thrash until he could hardly breathe. Another yell wailed across the room. It sounded terrifyingly familiar.
Ace! Fitz yelled. Don't!
Fitz tried to push his head against the webbing to look for the man.
Ace, where are you?
You want to see your friend?
The voice came from below, but Fitz couldn't see the source. Suddenly, the webbing lifted him like an octopus grabbing prey. It deposited him into the center of the room. A few tendrils remained wrapped around his torso and limbs, probing painfully at his nerves. Fitz saw the source of the voice, a bald man who looked to be in his 60s wearing a white lab coat. Acne scars pocked his upper cheeks, and a ragged beard hung under a pointed chin. He had one blue eye and one brown. Both were wild, like those of a crazy person. The scientist, or doctor, appeared human, but his skin was almost translucent. Blood vessels pulsed and protruded against his flesh. Fitz guessed the man hadn't seen daylight in years. The man walked to a lab station where he stopped at a computer that was connected to the webbing. With each stroke of the keyboard, vines rustled above Fitz until a writhing mass of vines lowered next to the scientist.
Ah, you're awake, the scientist said. I'm Dr. Lloyd. Welcome to my office.
Fitz said nothing.
Not quick to talk, are you? Lloyd said. Your friend hasn't been very talkative either.
He typed again, and a few vines of webbing recoiled in the wall, revealing Ace. Dark bruises covered his face and arms. Blood streamed from his nostrils, dripping into his beard. One of his eyes was swollen shut.
Don't,
Ace mumbled, his cracked, bleeding lips barely moving.
Let him go, Fitz said.
Lloyd glared at him with those wild eyes. Then he stepped over a vine of webbing on the floor.
You don't come to the land of the new gods and give me orders. You're weak. A slave.
Weak? Fitz asked. Let me out of this webbing and we'll see how weak I am, you fucking coward.
If that's what you want.
Lloyd tapped on the keyboard, and the webbing loosened, whipping from his fingers. Fitz fell a few feet, crashing to the floor. He immediately tried to stand, but instead fell forward. He had no way to stand. The chimeras had taken his prosthetics. All he could do was crawl toward the twisted scientist. Before Fitz made it 2 feet, Lloyd tapped on the keyboard, and the webbing wrapped around his thighs and chest, pulling him upright in their putrid grasp.
Your friend Ace wouldn't answer my questions, Lloyd said. If he won't, maybe you will.
Fitz said nothing.
Let's start with how you found this place.
Ace grumbled, drooling blood. Lloyd smiled a grin as yellow as a variant's eyes.
Is it just you and this man that came to the land of the new gods? Or are there more out there?
Fitz looked at the ground.
Make this easy on yourself.
We came alone, Fitz replied.
I think you're lying.
Lloyd raised a brow, his ugly face scrunching into a forest of wrinkles.
Are you?
Fitz spat, but the spit didn't make it far, and Lloyd simply grinned and retreated to the keyboard.
Have it your way, slave, he said.
We ain't going to tell you shit, Ace mumbled.
I wasn't asking you, old man, Lloyd said.
He tapped on the keyboard, and the red vines around Ace twisted, pulling his arms behind his back. Ace clenched his jaw, trying to hold strong and fight, but eventually it was too much, and he let out a scream of agony. Anger ripped through Fitz as he watched his brother in arms writhing in pain.
Stop, he shouted. Stop!
Finally, at the tap of a key on the keyboard, the webbing loosened. Ace spat out a mouth full of blood, then gasped for air.
That the best you got? He grumbled.
Lloyd shook his head, then turned away from the older operator.
Even if I believe you were dropped here alone, the Allied States military is much bigger than one old man and a crippled soldier. So tell me, how many soldiers does President Ringgold have?
Enough to fuck you up, Fitz said.
The vines around his chest tightened until he couldn't breathe. Seconds ticked by, his lungs burning worse. His vision swam with red as he neared unconsciousness. His captor finally tapped the laptop again, and the webbing loosened. Fitz sucked in a deep breath, his mind whirling. How the hell was he going to get out of this? All he could do was hope that Dohai was out there planning, coordinating their rescue. If he could just buy more time.
I'll ask one more time. How many soldiers are left?
Lloyd asked.
I don't know, Fitz stammered.
Lloyd hit the keyboard, and the vines squeezed again. Once more, Fitz approached the edge of unconsciousness before the webbing released its hold. He tried to breathe, but his lungs and ribs ached.
Last chance, Lloyd said.
Fitz tried to speak, but the words wouldn't come out. He was too weak. All he could do was shake his head. For a third time, he suffocated under the strength of the vines. The man walked over, focusing his blue and brown eyes as he hunched down.
You really won't like what happens next if you don't answer.
Fitz decided the only way to survive was to prolong the interrogation. When the questions ran out, so would his usefulness. They would be discarded just like any other human. Probably strung up for the beasts to feed on.
I'm getting bored with this game, Lloyd said. But I've got other methods.
All it takes is all you got, Fitz thought.
The motto helped ease some of the pain. Lloyd grinned again, a crazed look passing over his blue and brown eyes. He returned to the computer. Fitz stiffened, preparing for the vines to renew their assault, but this time they didn't tighten. Ace wailed in agony. The webbing pulled at his arms and legs, stretching him like he was on a medieval rack torture device. Sweat coursed over his bruised face, and a sickening pop echoed from what was probably a dislocated shoulder.
Fuck you! Ace yelled.
Fitz tried to stay strong. He could take all the physical pain in the world, but watching his friend, his brother like this, a dislocated limb was painful, but not ultimately debilitating. But if the vines kept stretching to the point of no return, it wouldn't just be Fitz missing limbs.
Stop, Fitz said. I'll tell you, just stop and I'll tell you.
Lloyd tapped a button on the keyboard and the vines let go of their iron grip. Ace panted, wincing.
Don't tell him anything, brother. Don't.
Fitz ignored him. He had to prolong their lives.
Ringgold has about 30,000 troops left, Fitz lied, all spread out between the Air Force, Navy, and Army.
Lloyd ran a hand over his bald, pale head, seeming to mull the answer over. Ace looked at Fitz, but hopefully he understood what Fitz was doing. 30,000 was a gross overestimation,
They had nowhere near those numbers. But if this man wanted answers, Fitz would provide them. They just wouldn't be the truth. Lloyd didn't seem entirely satisfied, but he moved on to other questions. The cycle repeated, over and over. Fitz did his best to endure the interrogation. Ace was tortured, cursing and pleading with Fitz not to say another word. And Fitz gave the crazy scientist some answers, almost all lies and exaggerations, sprinkling just enough truth to make it sound believable without compromising the country he had sworn an oath to protect. He wasn't sure how long he could keep doing this, how long before this hell on earth ended. Lloyd resumed torturing Fitz, the webbing yanking on his limbs, squeezing until he was certain he had a few cracked ribs.
"Please, Dohai, help."
But nothing changed. No one broke in to stop the torture. No explosions brought down the facility, and Dohai didn't show up with guns blazing. The pain finally stopped hours later when Lloyd yawned, cupping his mouth with a palm.
"I'm not stupid enough to believe everything or most of what you told me. But we'll have another chance to talk," Lloyd said. "And if I find out you're lying, well, I have plenty of mouths to feed around here."
Fitz said nothing, struggling merely to retain his consciousness.
"I'll get everything I want eventually," the scientist said with a yellow grin. "In the meantime, I need to rest."
Ace tried to spit, but the bloody spittle ended up mostly on his hairy chest. That got a laugh out of Lloyd.
"You've both seen the godly warriors we've created. Scions. Men with the power of the creatures you call variants."
He strode toward Fitz, getting close enough that Fitz could smell his stinking breath.
"I personally helped perfect the process of turning men into monsters. And if you're lucky, you'll both join our ranks like the other slaves I've captured," Lloyd said. "If you're not lucky, you'll end up as food for my army."
He tapped Fitz on the chest.
"Your choice, slave."
22. Timothy and Ruckley hid behind a pile of rubble outside of an abandoned two-story building. Embers drifted lazily around them, stinging against their fatigues. They were crouched, waiting for a chance to get to the parking lot past the still-standing walls of a lobster shack with an interior that had been gutted by fire. At the parking lot was the truck the Irishmen had traded for their sailboat. A pack of variants prowled the street, hunting for survivors. The popping of their joints grew distant, and Ruckley got up. "Okay," she said quietly. "Let's go." Timothy got up, but a high-pitched shriek forced him back down. Ruckley turned and pointed her rifle at a filthy variant cresting the mound of rubble, her aim shaky due to her injured arm. With no other option, Timothy fired into the beast's chest. It slumped, tumbling over its own limbs. Two more variants skittered down the rubble, pouncing at Timothy. He had no time to fire, but he did bring his gun up to smash one in the sucker lips with his butt, breaking out a mouthful of jagged teeth. The monster recoiled, giving him just enough time to blast a shot through its broken jaw. When his target crumpled, he turned to help Ruckley. The ash-covered creature had wrestled her to the ground, making it difficult for Timothy to find a clear shot. It snapped at her face and sunk claws into her already injured arm. She let out an ear-splitting scream. Timothy let his rifle drop on its sling and pulled out his knife. He ran at the beast and jammed the blade into its hairy flesh, tracing a deep crimson line over the black, diseased skin until it let Ruckley go. The variant flopped to the side, wailing until he silenced it by slitting its throat. He reached down and helped Ruckley stand. "We have to move," he said. She stood there, dazed, holding her injured arm. Blood soaked over her bandages. "Come on," he said. They staggered into the street, the shrieks of other variants calling out. The truck was only about 300 feet away, but they had to pass through the smoke drifting across the road. Timothy aimed his rifle at two more beasts that hung back in the cover. He waited for a clear shot,
unsure of how much ammo he had left. One of the beasts went down on all fours and started toward him in a gallop. He fired a shot that hit it in the neck. The other creature took off to flank, but he took it down with a shot to the knee and then another to the back. Ruckley was struggling to walk, and he went over to her to help.
"Almost there," he said.
She put her arm around his shoulder, and he guided her the rest of the way to the truck, scanning for more hostiles in the curtain of smoke. With her safely inside, he closed the passenger door and then went to the rear bumper. Using his rifle butt, he smashed out the brake lights to better conceal their drive out of town. Another quick scan of the area was clear, and he got into the driver's side, inserting the key and praying it would work. The truck fired right up. Finally, some good luck. He just hoped the rust-pocked Ford pickup was better than it looked. The fabric seats were torn, and the dashboard was cracked. It had to be 20 years old. A glance at the full fuel gauge at least confirmed the Irishman hadn't lied.
"Go,"
Ruckley groaned. Timothy pulled out of the lot and sped away from the burning outpost. Variants gave chase on the sidewalks. One creature leapt from a building at the truck, but Timothy turned sharply. It crashed against the asphalt, rolling over and over. Another creature barreled down the road beside them. It reached out to grab onto the vehicle, and this time, Timothy slammed it with the side of the truck, sending it skidding into a light pole. Ruckley winced as she gripped her arm. Blood poured out between her fingers.
"God," she said.
"You have to stop the bleeding," Timothy said. "The med pack is..." His heart fluttered when he realized he had left it at the debris pile when they were attacked by the variants.
"Shit!"
Timothy said, pounding the wheel.
"I have some bandages in my pack."
Her voice sounded weak. He debated pulling off, but that would be suicide. He had to keep going until they were clear of the city. Finally, he flipped on the headlights. He didn't like driving with the lights on, but he couldn't see shit out here. The cover of dark wouldn't matter if they ran into a tree or pile of rubble. In the rearview mirror, he saw the burning outpost, but looked away to focus on the road and the future, on people he could save, and those that he was going to kill. They had to get to a radio, and if he couldn't find one, then fuck it. He would just do what he should have done before, drive to Mount Katahdin. Even if it meant driving 100 miles per hour all night to get to the base, he would gut Nick and Pete before they could launch that nuke. Timothy pushed the pedal down. The engine rattled in response. The beams illuminated abandoned vehicles pushed up along the median and shoulder of the 2-lane highway. The headlights would make them a target to any waiting ambush, but it was impossible to maintain any speed without them. He just hoped the speed would make them less of a target if anyone or anything did decide to try and stop them.
"God damn,"
Ruckley said as she cut away her shirt to reveal the wound. The gashes were long and deep. She grimaced and then closed her eyes, taking in deep breaths.
"I have some antibiotics," and
she stopped.
"Timothy, watch out!"
He looked back at the road and swerved just in time to avoid a crashed motorcycle. The side of the truck ground against the median until he pulled them back into the left lane. He eased off the gas to about 60 miles an hour, his heart rate returning to normal.
"Keep your eyes on the road,"
Ruckley said, before returning to wrapping her arm, using her teeth to hold one end of the gauze. By the time she finished, the glow of the fire behind them had vanished over the horizon. From the corner of his eyes, Timothy saw Ruckley wincing. She was clearly in a lot of pain. There wasn't much he could do without stopping, but at least she had slowed the bleeding. The next hour passed by relatively quickly. It was almost 9 o'clock, and Ruckley seemed to be doing better. At this speed, he wouldn't get to the base until 3 in the morning. That was assuming they didn't run into any trouble, which seemed unlikely, especially when he spotted a roadblock formed by burning cars ahead.
"Shit," he said.
Ruckley pulled out her pistol. Timothy turned off the headlights and pulled off to the side of the road.
"I'll check it out," Timothy said. "I'm covering you," Ruckley said.
"No way. You're hurt.
Don't argue with me."
Timothy relented and got out. Together, they approached the wreckage from the right side of the road. The heat of the fire rolled over the pair. The closer they got, the more flaming debris he noticed. A tire burned in the middle of the 2 lanes. He crouched when he saw a charred body.
"I'll check it out," he said. "Cover me." Timothy ran toward it, with Ruckley holding up her pistol. As he moved, he caught the strong scent of charred flesh and burned hair. The glow of the burning vehicles revealed what remained of the clothes on the corpse. It looked like a standard-issue combat uniform. This was a soldier. He looked back up at the wrecked cars. This wasn't an intentional roadblock. This was the site of an ambush. They advanced toward two pickup trucks. The vehicles were torn open like they'd been caught in an explosion. More smoking bodies were scattered in the dirt on the side of the road and across the median. They navigated past the two trucks to find a Humvee. Its back tires were flat, and the rear bumper was scorched, but it wasn't burning. Timothy hurried to the front of the truck. The windshield was splintered from an onslaught of high-caliber rounds. Blood had splattered the glass of the side window. He opened the door to find the driver dead, punctured by multiple bullet holes. The passenger was slumped over against the door, his upper body covered in blood and riddled by gunshot wounds to his chest. Timothy turned on his flashlight and directed it at the dashboard. His heart kicked at the sight of the radio.
"Does it work?" Ruckley asked.
"Let's find out," he said. Timothy gently pulled the dead driver out and put him on the ground next to Ruckley. She watched the road with her pistol in her good hand. Sliding into the blood-stained seat, Timothy grabbed the receiver. With a twist of the channel selection dial, it buzzed to life. They had finally done it. They could warn command about Mount Katahdin. A flood of relief poured over him until he heard another voice.
"Drop your weapons."
The relief turned to shock. There was a working radio right in front of him, something he had been fighting to find for days, and now, right after they had found it, the collaborators had spotted him. He reached for his pistol, but the same voice came again.
"Don't touch that."
"We're friendlies," Ruckley said. Slowly, Timothy turned to see two soldiers wearing night vision goggles standing in front of the Humvee. They approached cautiously, carrying suppressed M4 rifles. Not collaborators after all, survivors of the convoy. Timothy raised his hands and backed out.
"Easy," he said. "We have an important message to send to command. We just need to use the radio."
Ruckley introduced her.